Welcome to the First Things podcast. On this episode, I'll talk with Carl Truman about Martin Luther, the German monk who dressed up as the wrath of God for Halloween. Carl will explain why Luther matters, whether Luther ushered in the secular age, which of the heroic reformers you'd rather be stranded on an island with, why Luther's vernacular Bible was so revolutionary, how Protestants and Catholics of today should talk to each other, and more. If you find the audio on this episode a little tinny, it's not my fault. It's them internet tubes. I'm senior editor Julia Yost. Thanks for joining us. On October 31st, 1517, an Augustinian monk named Martin Luther nailed his 95 Theses against Indulgences to the door of the Castle Church in Wittenberg and changed the course of history. Joining me via the internet to talk Luther and Reformations is Carl Truman. Carl is the William E. Simon Visiting Fellow in Religion and Public Life at Princeton University. He holds the Paul Woolley Chair of Church History at Westminster Theological Seminary, and he is pastor of Cornerstone Presbyterian Church in Ambler, Pennsylvania. He's also a frequent and beloved contributor to First Things. Carl, this 500th anniversary of the 95 Theses is being celebrated not just by Lutherans, but by Protestants of all sorts. So why is this anniversary so important? Why does Luther matter?
I think of all of the reformers of the 16th century, Luther is the central figure. It really doesn't matter if you're a Lutheran Protestant, or a Reformed Protestant, or even a sort of Baptist evangelical Protestant. To some extent, you track back to the protest of Martin Luther in the 1517 and beyond. No other reformer, I think, sets the agenda of Protestant theology in quite the same way. If you look at the second generation of reformers, say John Calvin, Martin Bucer, these figures by and large take their cue in responding to Luther. So Luther looms large for all Protestants as, if you like, the founder of the feast, the man in relation to whom we define ourselves to some extent.
Now, Luther is often praised or blamed for ushering in modernity. By dividing the church, he introduced religious choice, which Charles Taylor says is a precondition for the secular age. So what's your take on this? How important was Luther to the processes that produced modernity and secularization?
Well, on one level, one could sort of almost facetiously push back and say it wasn't Luther who introduced choice. You could go back to 451 and the refusal of the Coptic churches to affirm Chalcedon, or you could go to 1054 and the Great Schism between the West and the East to see divisions within the church generating choice. I think what makes Luther and the Reformation more significant on that front is that conceptually, the idea of choice becomes more familiar in the 16th century. There's still a sense, of course, in which choice could not really be realized by many people, really down until the 19th century. If you are living in Wittenberg in the late 16th century, you don't really have a choice of religions. You're going to be a Lutheran or you're going to be in severe trouble with the authorities. But what the Reformation does is make it conceptually possible to think about church division and religious choice in a way that was really unprecedented beforehand. I often say, one of the first things I say in class when I'm teaching the Reformation is to say to the students, if you were living in 1500 and had met Luther as a young man and had said to him, do you realize in 25 years' time there will be a choice of religions within the empire, broadly conceived? Luther would not have had even the abstract conceptual categories to be able to understand what you were saying. And yet, his life itself bears witness to the fact that he did create or help create to foster a situation where division was a reality and therefore choice was at least embryonically conceivable.
Now, recently in the Los Angeles Review of Books, very fine essay on Luther, you wrote, scholars can look to Luther to see either a key culprit in the rise of modernity or one of the last attempts to stop medieval Catholicism from destroying itself. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question how Luther relates to the modern age or how he relates to medieval Catholicism. There's no doubt that intentionally, when Luther nails the 95 Theses to the door, probably stuck them actually with a piece of wax, he probably didn't nail them, but when he stuck the 95 Theses to the castle church door in Wittenberg, he's not, the last thing in his mind is dividing the church at that point. He's really wanting to raise the question of the nature, the extent, the power of indulgences. He wants a university debate on the subject. I think if you trace out his work over the next three years or so, what he's really trying to do at that point is call the church back to what he thinks is faithfulness to biblical teaching that it's lost. So he's certainly not a man trying to split the church. He's not trying to create the conditions of modernity. Secondly, one could add to that that his theological method is really rooted in the Middle Ages. He's not innovator. He's trying to recover the historic testimony of the church. Whether he succeeds in that or not, of course, is another matter. But he's looking back in order to try to forge a theology that is more pristine and more faithful than that which he's experiencing in the contemporary situation in which he finds himself. Thirdly, and scholars are broadly agreed on this, I think now, is that much of his theology draws directly on medieval paradigms. If you compare him with somebody like Calvin, for example, Calvin is very much trained in Renaissance humanism. He's a man of the technical modern age or early modern age. Luther's a monk. That's about as medieval a calling as you can find. And his theology is very much rooted in late medieval paradigms. So he's certainly a medieval man. And you can even see that perhaps in some of his, we might describe them as cultural or perhaps psychological attitudes. Again, I say to the students at Westminster, if you've not walked through the woods late at night and being worried that the devil is physically going to jump out and try to grab you, you've not lived in Luther's world. That's the physical presence of evil for Luther is very powerful in a way that it just isn't for Calvin. You can read Calvin and not really find that kind of a sensibility at all. So Luther's very much in his own mind, I think, a man of the Middle Ages. What he does, of course, is he's instrumental in unleashing forces that actually lead to the falling apart of what we now characterize as the Middle Ages.
Right. So that's one of many ironies or contradictions that we can find in Luther's legacy and his character. And his character was as complex and contradictory as his legacy. And those contradictions have often been sharpened by polemicists on both sides of the Protestant-Catholic divide. So you can see him as heroic or as villainous, as prophetic or as insane, as virtuous or as obscene. What's your take on this very strange and complex personality?
Yeah, I suspect that were he alive today, he would probably be diagnosed with something like bipolar disorder. He's clearly a man of great emotional extremes, and he tends to swing from one extreme to the other. He's also a very, for want of a better term, he's a very pig-headed individual. That's both a strength and a weakness. A man who's not stubborn and pig-headed is not going to be able to stand at the Diet of Worms and effectively face down the massed ranks of the imperial nobility. On the other hand, the risk you run with a man who's so pig-headed is when he gets hold of the wrong end of the stick or he's on the wrong side of the argument, he's likely to be that much more obnoxious than the rest of us. And one thinks, for example, of his vitriolic writings about the peasants in 1525 or his terrible, terrible writings about the Jews in the early 1540s. Functions of the same personality, I think, a man of great extremes. He was also remarkably introspective. Certainly the matrix out of which his own Reformation theology emerges around about 1516 connects to a profound kind of introspection. that leads him on this sort of seesaw from despair to hope. And you find that when you read his biblical commentaries, for example, his second great commentary on Galatians from the early 1530s, you see there he's very much reading Paul through the lens of the extremities of his own emotional life. So a man of great extremes, also a man capable of remarkable sensitivity, pastoral sensitivity. One of his famous booklets is a booklet on prayer that he wrote for his hairdresser who was struggling with his prayer life, and Luther found time to write a little treatise just for his hairdresser to explain how he could improve his prayer life. And a man as well who knew a lot of personal tragedy in his own life. His account of the death of his young daughter Magdalena and how she talks to him about longing to go to be with her Heavenly Father, and about he has to turn away because he can't control his weeping and he's beating himself up for his lack of faith. Very, very moving. So, yes, a remarkably complicated character. I was once asked in a job interview who I'd rather be with on a desert island, John Calvin or Martin Luther, and I had to give Martin Luther the edge. There would be no embarrassing silences if one was in his company, I don't think, but also just a very, very human individual, in a way that a figure like Calvin comes across as a much colder and less three-dimensional character.
Let's talk a bit about Luther's example as it's received by various Protestant churches or denominations today. In what ways might Luther be exemplary for different types of Protestants, and in what ways might he be problematic? And maybe think about modern American evangelicalism.
Yes, I think the relationship between Luther and modern American evangelicalism is a fascinating one. Partly because, of course, the things that meant most to Luther are by and large things that a lot of American evangelicals have little time or patience with at all. So, for example, infant baptism. When Luther was tempted by the devil, he would say his response was always to tell the devil, "I've been baptized. Not that I've been converted or that I made the decision at a certain point in time, but I've been baptized." He had a very high view of baptism. And the Lord's Supper, of course, is something that he was willing to split Protestantism over. He always regarded transubstantiation, the Roman Catholic position, as less of an error than the slick view that he saw in people like Zwingli and the Reformed. And of course, sacramental theology, and particularly theology of the Lord's Supper, is not something with which American evangelicals would have much time at all. And yet you cannot understand Luther's contribution to historical theology, and you cannot understand the dynamics of his own life unless you place the sacraments right at the center. 1520, Babylonian Captivity Church, when he lays out his Manifesto of the Reformation, it's all about reforming and revising the sacraments. So when I read American evangelical interactions with Luther, by and large, what I see there is a figure being presented as something of a hero, a larger-than-life figure, but somebody who's really quite mythical in many ways. If Luther was alive today and held the same views that he held in the 16th century, I suspect he would not regard American evangelicalism really as a Christian movement, because it denies the real presence of Christ in the sacrament that for Luther was a basic hallmark of true Christian faith.
So what about your own tradition, Orthodox Presbyterianism? You have a heroic reformer of your own, John Calvin, though, as you say, maybe a bit of a cold fish compared to Luther. But how do you mark Reformation Day?
I think the Reformation is, as I said in answer to the very first question, I think it's a very, very important moment for all Protestants. Things that are important to us, like justification by grace through faith, the importance of Christian liberty, the importance of conscience, the importance of scriptural authority, these are all things that are very significant for us. I do have I hope, an appropriately nuanced approach to the Reformation, though, because it doesn't seem to me that it is an unmitigatedly good thing. One of the things, of course, that Catholics will criticize Protestants for is, you know, if you make the break with the authority of the church that you have, you will end up with countless denominations all falling out with each other. It's hard to argue that historically that hasn't happened. I mean, Protestantism is, when taken as a whole, is a chaotic mess. My own particular strand of it, confessional Presbyterianism, we try our best to respect historical trajectories of Christian thinking. You will typically not find somebody in my tradition talking about, well, it's all just down to me and my Bible. We read our Bibles in dialogue with the church tradition, particularly as we find that tradition mediated through the great ecumenical creeds of the church and also the 16th and 17th century Protestant confessions. So confessional Presbyterianism it's not quite American evangelicalism, because I think we have more of a respect for tradition and history than is typically the case in evangelicalism. But we too have been susceptible to many of the problems that Catholics will point at, an overzealousness for schism and for splitting and dividing from each other.
So you mention Protestant Bible reading, and I'm interested in Luther's participation in early Protestant biblical culture. Specifically, why was his vernacular translation of the Bible so important? It wasn't the first of its kind ever, but it was revolutionary in a way that others weren't. Why do you think that was?
Yes, well, I mean, there are a number of reasons for that. First of all, theologically, it was very important to Luther, because if you hold to justification by grace through faith, then words become important. Grasping the promise by faith becomes important, and it becomes important, therefore, for words to stand at the very heart of the church's life. So Luther had a broad vernacular project, we might say, with regard to religion. The Bible was to be in the vernacular so it could be read in the churches, and the liturgy was to be in the vernacular so that people could understand what was being said. I think what makes Luther's Bible distinctive, a couple of things. One, there's clearly the technological innovation of the printing press that is going to make production and distribution of Bibles that much easier, and is going to fuel a rise in literacy rates. I think Luther himself had an inexplicable and preternatural understanding of how the print medium worked. It's quite remarkable that he was even fussy over what fonts would be used for his books, his works, his Bibles, because he knew that certain fonts appealed aesthetically to readers and would make it easier to read. So there's that aspect to it as well. And I think what Luther does in the Great Luther Bible is produce a work that, well, helps in some ways found the modern German language. It stabilizes German language in a way that had not been done before, and becomes a central part of German-speaking culture in a way that, for example, Calvin's Institutes in the French tradition was in France, or the King James Version of the Bible and the Book of Common Prayer became in England. The role of Bible reading in the church really did press a certain stabilized form, literary form of German upon the people. And the other aspect of his Bible, of course, as well, not so much literary, but the pictures are great. I have a facsimile of Luther's German Bible sitting in my dining room. You know, it didn't matter if you couldn't read, the pictures sort of told you the story as well. So I always found it somewhat ironic that a religious movement built on the importance of words was actually communicated by and large by pictures to many people in the 16th century. That's something that modern-day Catholic polemicists might like to pick up on, I guess.
I'll keep that in mind.
Thanks, I'm sure you will.
Let's also talk about Luther's political thought, yeah, which has been caricatured as reactionary or proto-totalitarian.
Yeah.
But how would you characterize Luther's politics?
Yeah, Luther's politics, of course, the discussion of Luther's politics has been made much more complicated by Nazi Germany in the 20th century, because not only were Lutheran pastors complicit, many of them complicit in the Nazi regime. Luther's own works against the Jews were republished as part of a propaganda campaign. So there is a problem. As soon as you approach Luther's politics today, the Holocaust and Nazi Germany loom large. I think what Luther was trying to do in his time was properly separate out the role of the church and the state by pointing to the competence of each in their separate spheres. What that does in practice, I mean, Luther believes that every individual, therefore, is a member of effectively two kingdoms. Everybody's baptized and is a member of the kingdom of Christ in the church, but everybody is also a member of civic society and subject to the authority of the civil magistrate. The key thing for Luther is that the civil magistrate is put in place by God. It's a divine appointment. Now, where that gets complicated, of course, is what happens if you have a tyrant? What happens if you've got somebody who is not using their God-given power to protect the innocent and to put down the guilty and the wicked? The question of rebellion looms its head. And Luther's argument really was, you can't rebel against a God-given magistrate. That person is put there by God, and to rebel against God's representative in the civil realm is to rebel against God. And that's often been taken to justify a kind of supine attitude before the civil magistrate. In actual fact, Luther's position is more complicated in two ways. One, Luther doesn't believe that you have to obey the civil magistrate if the civil magistrate commands you to do something wicked. He doesn't believe it's legitimate to rebel against him. So if we would take a modern example, let's say I'm working in a hospital as a doctor and I'm instructed by the registrar to perform an abortion. I, as a Lutheran, can refuse to do so because that's wicked. It's my civil governor in that situation asking me to do something that's wicked. I can absolutely refuse to do it. But I must accept that the registrar then has a right to fire me for not doing my job, and I mustn't sue them. So we could say that you can certainly, I think, build out of Luther a kind of passive resistance ethic. Certainly, if you were in Nazi Germany and were commanded to drop the Zyklon B crystals through the roof of the gas chambers at Auschwitz, you should refuse to do it. And if you were shot because of that, well, they're entitled to shoot you for disobeying orders, but you mustn't do wickedness. The second little nuance to Luther is that he does actually change his opinion. One of the things I love about studying church history is you realize just how pragmatic most of the great figures are. 1530, the Holy Roman Emperor refuses to subscribe the Augsburg Confession and make the empire Lutheran. And Luther then changes his mind on resistance, and he says that because the emperor is elected by the seven electors, his power therefore comes from them, and therefore they are able to resist him. And you have the beginnings there of the kind of resistance theory of the lower magistrate to the upper magistrate, which will be elaborated by Calvin. So Luther's view of politics, I think, is often misrepresented. There are grounds for a kind of passive resistance to wicked rulers, and he himself nuanced his position later to allow for more active resistance.
Yeah, Carl, I wanted to ask you to compare Luther's political thought with John Calvin's, and maybe talk about how the latter develops the former.
Yes, I think what you have in Calvin, well, first of all, you have very different contexts. Calvin is operating in Geneva. It's an urban context with a form of representative government. It's not democracy as we understand it, but it's a kind of aristocratic representation. So Calvin always works much more closely with the city councils than Luther does. Luther has a prince, and the prince basically sets the political agenda. It's by and large favorable to Luther, so he goes along with it. What you find in Calvin is a much closer active relationship between church and state. Calvin himself wants considerable freedom for the church from the state, not in a Jeffersonian sense, but certainly in the sense that the church should be able to appoint its own pastors and conduct its own discipline. He can never achieve that. There are always some representative of the civil authorities in the process for appointing pastors and for conducting discipline. So Calvin has to work much more closely with the civil magistrate. But what you get in Calvin in terms of resistance theory is a much clearer idea that are much more explicitly stated that lower magistrates can resist higher magistrates. And the church itself can stand or should stand free of magistrate interference. That's very helpful for Calvin because, of course, he's sending, he's training men and sending pastors back to France, which is Catholic country, predominantly hostile to his form of Protestantism. So he needs a model of the church that can prosper in independence from the civil magistrate, and his political thinking gives him that. But in Calvin, I say the key thing, I think, is a much clearer emphasis upon the resistance of a lower magistrate to a higher magistrate. And that is a kind of staging post towards the more full-blown resistance theories that you'll find in somebody like Christopher Goodman, or even more notoriously John Knox in the later part of the 16th century.
Now, Carl, you're a convert. So what's your story? Why Christianity and why confessional Presbyterianism?
It's so long ago I can hardly remember. I've been a Christian so long, it's difficult for me to imagine the world as not being one. I think I came to Christian faith sometime between the ages of 17 and 20. I think it just made sense to me. I became acutely aware of the existence of God. I became acutely aware of my own unworthiness to stand before Him. And really, through reading the works of J.I. Packer, the great British, now Canadian, evangelical writer, I found an approach to the Bible which seemed to make sense of the text as I read it and I heard it preached on a Sunday, and which pointed me to Christ as the means by which my sins could be forgiven. So nothing particularly earth-shattering, but it just made sense of what I regarded as my own predicament and what I saw from the Bible as being the human predicament. How can we stand before a righteous God?
Though you are a Calvinist, you notably have a good rapport with Catholics. You're on friendly terms with Archbishop Chaput in Philadelphia, and you have many appreciative Catholic readers. So you're well positioned to comment on Catholic-Protestant relations. And so I wanted to ask you, what do you think is the value of ecumenism these days?
I think it depends what kind of ecumenism you're looking at. I mean, you're right, I enjoy very good and warm friendships now with quite a number of Catholic friends and have learned much from them. I think that kind of informal ecumenism, I think, is very, very helpful. I've learned a huge amount from my engagements with the Archbishop and with Fran Meyer and Matt Frank and people like that who are part of the First Things orbit. And it's helped sharpen my thinking on a lot of what I would call the sort of common Christian doctrines that Protestants and Catholics share, doctrine of the Trinity, incarnation. I think the differences between myself and my Catholic friends have also been extremely helpful to me in forcing me to think more clearly about what I believe relative to the doctrine of the Church and the sacraments. Those kind of things I found personally very helpful. I think one of the interesting things for me is when I think of the great Catholic doctrines of the faith, like the Trinity and the Incarnation, it's become pretty patently obvious over the last year or two that quite a lot of Protestantism doesn't hold to the Trinity and the Incarnation as historic Christianity does. And that raises some very interesting questions for me at a more formal ecumenical level. It's one thing to have good Christian friends who come from different traditions. It's another thing to engage in formal institutional ecumenism. And I would be very interested, I think, in the next decade or 15, 20 years, if I live that long, to see if proper, thoughtful dialogue between conservative, traditional, Orthodox Roman Catholics and traditional, Orthodox, historic Protestants develops in a fruitful direction. I know we have evangelicals and Catholics together, and I've told Rusty and Tim George in the past, both of whom are involved, that one of my questions there is that the answer seems to be contained in the title, Evangelicals Catholics Together. For me, the question of whether we're together is one worth asking. I'd like to see something like evangelicals or Protestants and Catholics in dialogue emerging, where we can sit around the table and talk honestly about our differences without necessarily being committed to full or even partial agreement at the end of the day, but in a way where we can definitely learn from each other, both in terms of our personal testimonies and in terms of the witness of our respective churches about the historic Christian faith and its relevance for today.
I'm going to ask Connor, my junior fellow, whether he has any ideas for things we should include. He's a recent convert himself.
I am. What sort of conditions would you imagine need to be realized in order for the protest of Protestantism to be successfully lodged and seen through? On what issues or what questions is the protest of the Reformation still present for us?
Yeah, well, I sort of answer this, I suppose, in a really personal way. If I was sitting at that table with this mythical entity, Protestants and Catholics in dialogue, I think the big issues for me would be the issue of authority. What is the authority to which we look, and how is that authority mediated in the church? I think the role of the sacraments would be critical as well, and that would connect, of course, to understanding of justification. So I think those two would be the big issues for me. In a way, they were the big issues in the 16th century as well, and I think that they've not yet been fully resolved. I'm very encouraged chatting to my friend Matthew Levering, who teaches at Mundelein Seminary. I've found a lot of what Matt has written over the years to be extremely helpful. It seems to me that the distance between some Reformed Protestants and some very thoughtful Roman Catholic theologians is not as great, perhaps, as we might have anticipated it. But those would be the two areas, I think, where Protestants and Catholics would find their most sharp disagreements. We share a common Trinitarian understanding of God. We share an understanding of the Incarnation. I don't think those two things are significant points of contention between us. But authority and the role of the sacraments, I think that's where the discussion would have to take place.
Last set of questions. What would a Luther look like today? What kind of reform do we need? What sorts of negations? What sorts of affirmations?
Yes, Luther today is an interesting question. I think certainly there are some hardy perennials that one could take from Luther and drop down today. Claire, I think Luther's passion to have Christians knowing their Bibles better is clearly something that we always need that in the church. I think Luther wanted to rightly maintain the medieval Catholic emphasis upon the gathering of the church, that it's important to be together in worship. That physical component is extremely important. I suspect what would concern him most today would be the selling out of Christianity to the wider culture. The way that Christianity has always engaged with culture, it's always been shaped, often to its hurt, by the wider culture. But we live in a time when the forces of popular culture are so powerful and their message is so antithetical to the message of historic Christianity that I think probably the number one burden for Luther would be, how do we maintain the pristine gospel in a context where most Christians, most of our congregations are going to be exposed to very, very powerful anti-Christian messages through the media 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I think a Luther today would be wanting to reflect long and hard on how the church can address that particular pastoral challenge. And I suspect he'd come up with an answer that said that, you know, 1 hour on a Sunday morning, maybe 1 hour on a Sunday morning, 1 hour on a Sunday evening, just isn't enough to shape the Christian mind in a way that's going to enable it to withstand the transformative, negatively transformative influence of the wider culture.
Well, maybe I'll issue a sort of Newman-esque challenge, which is that particularly American evangelicals, but Protestants writ large, often construe their protest in historical terms. So American evangelicals today most famously will say that, with the rise of Constantine in the early church, something really soured. There was a sort of corruption of the pure strand of the faith, and it was lost and not recovered until the Reformation, or it was barely preserved in a couple of underground sects. Others will choose different dates, but I'm curious what you make of that logic.
Yes, that's a very, very good question. I think a lot of evangelical historiography constructed in that way, it's highly problematic. It's, in some ways, it's a little bit like Fox's Book of Martyrs, the great 16th century martyrology, which traces, which ultimately in its final 16th century edition goes from the early church up to the English Reformation. The problem with a book like Fox's is that many of the people who were executed as heretics in the Middle Ages would have been executed by the Protestants. I find the idea of the great fall of the church with Constantine, or at whatever point you care to put it, 1054 or whatever, to be less than plausible, because the texts just don't say that. I think my own approach is, again, an I found Newman quite helpful on this point. My own approach is much more to see the church in terms of a faithful strand of what I would regard as Pauline, Augustinian teaching and Trinitarian teaching that is traceable from the ancient church through the Middle Ages up to the Reformation. That kind of dogmatic history, I think, is a much better way of construing the history of the church. The problem with that, I think, from an evangelical point of view, is that it does presume a kind of doctrinal development. And often when you talk to evangelicals, as soon as you talk about doctrinal development, what they hear is, oh, the truth has changed over time. That's a really bad thing. I don't think that doctrinal development at all requires that. And I think Newman is very helpful in that regard. But that, I think, is what Protestant evangelicals will hear. Part of my project, both in terms of my own scholarly work and the stuff I've been trying to do for the more theological stuff I occasionally tried to do for First Things relative to Newman, is to try to plot a middle path, if you like, a via media, to use a Newman type term, between Roman Catholicism on the one hand and evangelical biblicism on the other, and to try to reflect upon, is there a true Catholic tradition here that Protestantism can lay claim to, that makes sense of the theological debates as we see them developing in history, make sense of doctrinal development, and does not require us either to capitulate to the great claims of Rome and the papacy, or to dissolve into the kind of naive biblicism that one often finds among evangelical Protestants. My hope is that I get guys like yourself, Connor, who are thinking of converting to Roman Catholicism, but persuade them to convert to confessional Presbyterianism instead. But obviously, I arrived too late in the day for you. Maybe next time. Hey, if you're thinking of converting again, give me a call.
That's all for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to Carl Truman and to my colleague, junior fellow Connor Grubaugh. Thanks to our listeners, especially our Protestant listeners. Best wishes in this festive year. No Lutherans, Calvinists, Zwinglians, or Anabaptists were harmed during the making of this episode.